All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm going to give my next guest a call here in a minute or so. We're actually going to be simulcasting on another radio show, and he's currently probably playing a song or something like that, waiting on me to give him a message and call him in. So I'm actually just going to mute out for a few seconds here and send him a message, and hopefully everything will be okay. Won't be too much of silence, but just a few seconds here. But what we're actually going to be doing is one of the other networks I'm on, People's Internet Radio, which all three other guests that I had on the first hour, they're also in my other network. And Sherry Wisdom, she has her own show on Saturday nights, and I help produce it, so I'm on the show. But she calls herself a Wiccan, and I don't even know what that is. Not too sure, really. I guess it's some sort of thing that's kind of out there. I don't know whether she's into the... I don't even know what the New Age is really called myself. I think it's just a criticism of something that's more of an ancient and older way of thinking and believing. And to criticize it, to call it New Age, I think is something that the Catholic Church does to try to minimize the message. And I'm not really sure how many things that are involved in what this so-called New Age is. I think yoga might be one of these. I think meditation, healing meditation, might be another. I'm not totally positive, but I don't know. I think that the Catholic Church has had a stronghold on a lot of people's minds over a long period of time, close to 2,000 years now, for structured religion. And the Catholic Church has been the at the forefront for that for a long time. It only seems logical that if somebody does have control for that long of a period of time, that they would try to manipulate people into believing something else. I think I did mention during the first hour. Well, I do need to also mention we are listener supported, so please go hit that donate button if you like what we're doing here. New Age is used by Protestants more. Well, Kevin, I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Cabal on Revolution Radio, and I'm on People's Internet Radio also, and PSN Radio and BBS Radio. I have four networks I do shows on, but I think I was, I'm not sure about the Protestants. Well, the Protestants are just a spin religion off of the Catholic Church, Kevin. But the Catholic Church has had a control on most of the world's people for a long, long time with structured religion. I think I did mention, I was going to mention there a minute ago, but in the first hour, there was a time the Catholic Church was charging people for penance if they did a sin in the eye of the church, whether it was, doesn't really matter what it was. If they sinned, they could go to their local parish and pay a penance. And be absolved for their sin. And it's still the same way, basically. Okay, everyone, I will be right back here in just a few seconds. I need to start a new call to do the other call. All right, and I'm back here, so. Sorry, I'm calling. It's just, okay, call failed. Guess we're not ready yet. But I'm trying to bring up Vin Byrne of People's... Hello.
Okay, and we should have Stephen on the line there now, and I just have to add you in, Stephen. Just give me 2 seconds.
I am, and as I mentioned, everybody on Revolution Radio, I'm simulcasting on People's Internet Radio with Vincent Byrne.
Now, we just have to resize you there, Stephen. Sorry about this. Just give me 2 seconds. We did have this set up earlier, but I was unaware that you were going to call in like that. And we should be able to... I think that's it sorted now. How's that? That look okay, you're right, Stephen?
Yes, that's okay.
All right, a little bit of maneuvering, maybe. Good enough. So, Stephen, we're now live on Revolution Radio as well. Hello, everybody on Revolution Radio. Vin B, or the Vinnie Byrne Show is what I'm going to call it from now on. And delighted to be on with Stephen Roberts. Myself and Stephen have known each other. We go back a bit, Stephen. How far back now?
2.5 years.
About 2.5 years. That sounds about right. And so what do we call this? Is this a simulcast? Is that what they call it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So I don't know if you had any particular topics you wanted to cover, Stephen. Had you anything lined up in particular, or will I fire off what I had in mind?
Well, I have sort of introduced the official offer to America one other time. I had you on the show for 30 minutes, but I thought that was a very, very good topic to discuss.
Sure, absolutely. Very close to my heart and many others. Essentially, what the official offer process is a means to operate with your bank when either in inverted commas default, unintended default, preferably, or if you know you're going to go into default sometime soon, i.e. you think you're going to lose your job in 6 months' time, or your whatever your circumstances are going to change to such a degree that you're no longer going to be able to honor these obligations in full. The methodology at the moment is being improved, and in fact, the new improved version should make a huge difference. The idea being that we address every single issue, question, or concern, the bank or lending institution, whatever they are, we address every single issue they have in advance. By that I mean, Stephen, that, you know, if I know, for example, in 6 months' time, I owe you 100 quid, shall we say, and I can't pay you, Stephen. You're a nice fella, I like you and all, but I just can't pay you. I wish I could, but I can't. So the only thing I can do is I must solve all your problems as best I can. So that's the way we treat the bank. I say, look, we approach the bank and we say in advance, we say, here are my incomings, my outgoings. And we have sheets done up so you can put down all the relevant information. You provide that to the bank in advance, and you also make to the bank an official offer from you, and you staple, that's very important, that it's stapled to that document with all the other documents as well that you're going to send. You're going to send all the information the bank could possibly require. The reason you're going to do this is because if you don't do it this way, if you allow the bank, for example, to approach you, Stephen, and say, well, I want all these different sets of information from you, Stephen. I want to know your ingoings, your outgoings, and all of this stuff. We have found that those documents generally contain other, I'm going to use the term, sneaky paragraphs or sneaky little legal tricks, whereby essentially if you're agreeing to adopt those processes with the banks, effectively if you can't hold up your end, and they will keep it so tight, I would imagine it would be near impossible for most people to keep up their end in that regard, you're actually agreeing in advance to essentially handing over possession of your family home. And we don't think that that's a reasonable proposition in any way, shape or form. I don't think anybody else really should. Or at least I've never met anybody, Stephen, in that position who felt that that was a good thing to do, you know, to just hand over the keys of their home. Everybody needs a roof over their head. And no matter where you are, whether in your hot country or a cold country, you need a roof. So maybe I fire it over to you, Stephen. Is there any particular poignant questions you think you'd have that would be more suitable to an American audience, for example?
Well, I wanted to play the devil's advocate and show it for the camera there. It's, hey, Vin, I got all these papers here. You know, I got this contract here. What do you say about that?
Congratulations. Well, welcome to the world of commerce. Okay, so maybe that's the first thing we got to look at is most people really need to go and research the seven elements of contract law. Now, you really only need to know, I suppose, four definitely. Offer, acceptance. That's acceptance with an A.
Contract here.
Offer.
What do you say about that?
Oops, I'm getting a repeat there, Steve.
Yeah, I turned the video feed on there and I just had to mute it. Sorry.
So it's offer, acceptance, consideration, performance. Consideration, if you will, is most people will consider it the monetary value. You know, it's not exactly what it is, but essentially it's whatever is considered valuable, even if it's just your promise. So with those four elements, most contracts are formed, assuming the other elements, you know, that you're old enough, you have the intellectual capacity, it's a lawful contract with certainty of terms, et cetera, et cetera. All those that are sub-elements, I'm going to call them. But assuming they're all in place, Stephen, and you think, okay, you have a valid contract, that document you had in your hand, you had signed it, right? You voluntarily walked into the bank and said, hey, banker guys, can I borrow money to do X, Y, Z?
That's right.
Right. So what's important to note about this is not some way of welching out or weaseling out or whatever terminology. What do you use for that terminology over there, Stephen?
Welching out, yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. So you're not trying to welch out on a bet. You're not trying to be dishonorable. You're not trying to get away with not
weasel.
Paying. Weasel, right.
Weaseling out, that's what it is, yeah.
Okay. So in other words, the idea is that this is for people who are genuine people, who are going to be absolutely honest with themselves first. That's the first thing, with your family, if you have family around you, it's a family home, you must be honest with your family. Explain this to your family. I don't mean your kids, etc. I mean your wife, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. The significant other in your life. Honesty with them. Let them know you're going to be in trouble, potentially, but that there is a potential remedy for you. Honesty with them, honesty with the bank. So you then tell the bank basically everything, and we've laid out a type of a format, I suppose, for all that. And you're going to offer the bank the absolute maximum you can. You're going to give them all the information in advance. You're going to explain to them why you're going to have to do this. You're going to rely upon certain elements of probably the Irish Constitution and the American Constitution, depending on where you're at. You can do that too. There's lots of case law, for example, in relation to contracts going bad that people should probably look up, and they'll get a good understanding as to why this is a sound idea. We've had barristers and solicitors and even a judge, a retired judge, suggest that this is a good process and that it makes sense and it's logical and it's reasonable and you're not trying to do anyone out of anything. So the idea is you bundle this all together. You get all this information together. You send it to the bank, and you would also include in that instructions to the bank. In other words, for example, if the bank don't want to accept any of this, here is the process for the bank. If they wish to negotiate, perhaps, here is the process. If they wish to, say, inspect the account and examine and say, well, we think you can pay more, well, we're giving you everything there. Here are my receipts, etc. Photographs, copies of receipts, photocopies of receipts, etc. You can supply it all to them. Now, I know a lot of people might be thinking, well, Genie, I'm exposing myself here big time, all my private transactions. Yeah, absolutely. And the reason you're going to do that is because I don't think you should have any fear in this instance, Stephen. I think this should be something we should be able to say, okay, even if there are corrupt individuals in the banking industry, which there more than likely are, let's not compound it by making it a bigger deal than it has to be. I mean, if you genuinely can't afford your mortgage, if your bank won't negotiate with you, and if you've tried this, if you've attempted to do the absolute best you can, we've essentially been told by judges and barristers, etc., that it's highly unlikely a judge can make a determination that goes against you. In fact, it's more likely that once you're being honest and reasonable and open, that the judge will, in fact, instruct the bank to accept your offer, to accept it. So we're not looking to beat the banks. We're not looking to beat the court system here. We're not looking to try and pull a fast one on anyone. It's simply that this is the reality of the position people find themselves in. They can't actually afford to perform to the full extent on the contract. They're not looking to break the contract. They're not looking to go into breach. Any breach or potential breach is unintentional. And therefore, that they should get the benefit of the positive aspects of the legal system, as well as common law. I mean, it's the oldest remedy in the world, Stephen, for common law. If I can't owe you, or if I owe you and I can't pay you, well, most people will say, well, it's a dollar down and a dollar a week type of thing until we're squared up. You know, I don't think anybody should really have any difficulty with that. So that's the idea. Any other questions you want to throw in there at the moment? Or,
well, I wanted to share with the Revolution Radio audience and the People's Internet Radio audience. It was in 2004. I was going through a bankruptcy. I had went on disability and started collecting the federal pension, as you call it over there. I was getting really, really rough on making payments on my mortgage and that. And I even had a friend try to help make the payments because he was living there and I wasn't, but, things just got too rough. So instead of being foreclosed on and, losing the home, I went through the bankruptcy and, ended up selling the home short, as they call it, a short sell. It didn't sell for the amount that I owed on it. So it was very, very close. It was like more than 95% of the selling price. But anyways, the bankruptcy lawyer told me a lot of these things. He said, if you wanted to save your pickup truck or try to stay in your home or do anything like that, he said I could make partial payments on my utilities, on my truck, what it would cost for the truck each month, and this, that, and the other. But he fell short of telling me I could do this on my home. He said I would have to make full payments on my home if I wanted to stay into it. I think you're muted. I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. How about that now?
Sure. That's good.
Which is interesting when you think about it. You think, why would he know about the system of the official offer process? I mean, the official offer process, by the way, just so everybody knows, that's the name we gave to it, just simply because it's you making an official offer from you to another entity, bank, etc. You won't find it called that in a legal book. In legal books, you'd be looking up things like the doctrine of substantive or substantial performance. It would be that type of thing you'd be looking up in law books, I suppose. But essentially, it's that's what I say. Isn't it unusual that, or odd slightly, that he knew about what we call the official offer process for all the other entities, but not for the bank, not for the house? Why do you think that was, Stephen?
Well, it seems that they've been in cahoots with each other for a long, long time now, and they basically over here, the conspiracy is, and I think it's all over the world too, but banks want the land, they want the property. So if they can get it fraudulently or illegally, they will try to do it.
I don't know if they as such want the land as such. I think more than likely what's more reasonable is that they want the ability to refinance and refloat that loan again on the stock market, etc., to generate more finance to keep themselves going. I think that's, you know, banks don't necessarily want, because as soon as they get land and houses, they resell it on again. Now, I think it's more, particularly what's happening over there at the moment in America, I think it's more than likely what they're looking for is they're looking to obtain land and then to shift it into some form of, inverted commas, government ownership rather than refinance it back to the people, because government contracts, you see, they don't welch out on government contracts with a bank. So it's a more stable contract as far as the bank is concerned. I think that's more likely what they're trying to do in that regard. What's the name of that big area of land over there that's happening? This is happening, the ranchers with the fires. What's that called at the moment?
I haven't really paid much of attention to it, but think there is...
Well, it seems to be something along those lines that's going on over there, rather than that they just want the land. I mean, the land itself is no good to a bank unless they can...
Federal Refuge Center, that's what it is.
Right, but unless they can get some other schmo to come on there and to start providing a stream of income or finance, you know, it's no good to them, right?
Yeah.
Which is why, for example, here in Ireland, as many people know, they're talking about, even though we have a countless amount of houses built, brand new houses built and sitting idle, and we have a growing homeless population because they're being repossessed, their properties are being repossessed, yet the government's solution is not to say, well, we have all these houses here that are just built and lying idle, why not let the people use them? No, their solution is, in fact, to purchase new I'm going to call them container homes or prefabricated homes, like trailers, like a different version of a trailer park trailer, I suppose, and set them up because, you see, they can get financed to do so. They can re-borrow. They can keep this machine going rather than just handing someone a set of keys and saying, well, look, there's a brand new house that's built. No one's lived in it. Just go in there and take care of it. In fact, what they're actually doing, and I know they're doing this in America as well, they're bulldozing those houses. They're just leaving, just cleaning off the site, and they're leaving the concrete slab so that if they ever want to, you know, another builder down the road ever wants to come in and refinance to rebuild, and he can get sales, etc., get people to move in, they'll do that. But they're destroying all the homes, and they're claiming they're doing it for environmental issues that, you know, well, if we leave those homes there with nobody living in them, essentially mold and fungal infections get into the home, into the timbers, etc., and they just rot. So they're saying, oh, for the good of the environment. So that's what's happening here as well, more or less.
Yeah. I've heard in the last few years, Ben, that I guess the saying goes that there really isn't much of an incentive for a bank to own a home. But I've also heard that when somebody takes out a mortgage, the banks can make up to five times the money that they normally would off of that loaner by defaulting on the loan and repossessing it.
Well, there's a movie, I don't know if you've seen it, that's been, it's only a recent release as far as I know, called The Big Short. Have you seen that?
Not yet. I'm going to watch it though, yes.
Wow. Well, I've seen it, and I'm just going to, let me just find it here now. Okay, I'm just going to put a little something in the chat there. That's the link that was sent to me. But in that movie, The Big Short, essentially, it's not all of the scam is exposed. They expose enough of it that if you're aware of how banking operates, and I think a vastly increased population now understand or comprehend at least some of why banking as a system is corrupt. So a lot of it is exposed in that movie, but not the usury part. They don't go into the reason all of these things can actually happen is because usury is in the monetary system, which, again, I find baffling, Stephen, considering, you know, America and Ireland and many other nations in the world are supposedly Christian nations. And the one thing that Christ got upset about was usury in the monetary system. It was the one thing he really, you know, if you read the Bible, etc., it's the one thing that really upset him in that regard. And again, I'm not trying to push any particular belief here. I'm just saying, you know, you can read that in the Bible. That's the way it is. That that was the one thing that upset him to the point where he overturned tables and was pulling out the whip. So I would suggest, well, why would that be in there? And I think we're seeing the results of why we should not have usury in our monetary system, regardless as to whether it came from the Bible or any religious text, and in fact, any ancient text even, is that if you have a monetary system with usury in there, which is essentially the charging of interest, is that sooner or later, as Mike Montagna from Mathematically Perfected Economy would say, it will terminate in insoluble indebtedness. That is, essentially, all of the nations will run out of vital circulation. They will run out of currency to do transactions with each other because it all gets vacuumed back out of your vital circulation via interest. And the interest, of course, is never introduced into the system. Therefore, the only finance we have to pay interest from is the money that's in circulation. The problem with that, of course, is we, every time we make an interest payment, it is us, we the people, who are reducing the money in circulation. We're actually destroying our own circulation. For example, cash is supposed to be for private transactions. But we keep lodging cash back into the bank again. Therefore, people have to keep reborrowing that same cash to get it back out again, or they take it out of an ATM and there's a fee.
Sure.
Or whatever.
I got a question from you, from the Revolution Radio chat there, Ben. It's, Patrick says, doesn't mean interest is bad if it's not high. Do they deserve some consideration for the use of their money?
Okay. Interest is always bad, and I'll tell you why. There are other ways, for example, for banks, if they wish to exist in that situation. Like having fixed fees for things is one thing, but the money still must be introduced somewhere into the economic system. At present, no interest is introduced. In other words, if 10 million or $10 trillion is put into circulation tomorrow via whatever mechanism, whether it's the banks doing it or the government's borrowing it, the interest portion, that's going to be 10 trillion plus whatever interest, that interest is never put into circulation. In other words, no money of interest is put into circulation that you can collect to pay back whatever. In other words, you don't have, say, a plus dollar and a negative dollar. So you can hand that as $2. So $1 is plus to pay the debt and the other dollar is negative to evaporate the interest. Because that's not in place, the interest just keeps growing and essentially it grows exponentially. When you have exponential growth, that usually means you have a certain length of time before that monetary system falls into terminal indebtedness. Usually
into a black hole, right?
Yeah, usually it was about 70-year cycles. And if you look at most wars, most of the wars that have happened, they seem to line up, don't you know, with these 70-year cycles. Now, what's happening now because of the internet and the speed of transactions and the ability people have to perform in more transactions nowadays than they did, say, 50 years ago, the currencies aren't lasting as long because the interest is consuming the currency in circulation quicker and quicker and quicker, you see. So in answer to Patrick, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, in answer to Patrick's question, no, any interest at all in that system will be terminal. It would be like every time I gave you a glass of water, I put one drop of poison into it. And let's say that poison is, one drop won't kill you, but over time it accumulates in your system. In other words, let's say every time you drink that glass of water and you have to drink the water to survive, say, if there's one drop of poison in that water, and let's say it takes a million drops to kill you, sooner or later, you're going to have to drink 1 million drops of that poison, which will dramatically shorten your lifespan. That's what's happening with interest in the monetary system. It's a drop of poison in your water. It's exactly the same. We don't actually need a banking system anyway. I mean, Mathematically Perfected Economy can take care of all of these issues. And I really would encourage people to go and research that, perfecteconomy.org, or contact Mike Montagna, do a Google search. But it's even worse than that, Stephen. The banking system has grown to such a degree that it's, and I believe this happened many, many, many years ago, that it actually became the world government, because no politician can get elected without getting financed from a bank.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. There's no more to it. The corporations approach the congressmen, etc., to lobby for whatever they want. They pad out the congressman or woman's pockets, etc. We've seen all of this, corruption. and they get their way, the legislation comes into place, and even if the corruption is spotted down the road, have you noticed, nobody ever goes back and says, oh, well, therefore, that legislation is now null and void.
Null and void, yeah.
All those transactions. That never happens. Leave the legislation in place.
It's pretty funny, Vin. About a year ago, the gas prices over here were right around the $4 a gallon mark. And then just mysteriously in the last 6-7 months, they started dropping drastically, like in half or even more, 55% more. And the claim that a lot of the prices of food, clothes, just everything was, well, the gas is so priced, so the gas prices are so high that we have to raise other prices to make up for it. But mysteriously, since they've dropped in the last 8 months, none of the prices have dropped. They've all stayed the same.
Well, you see, again, this is what's happening, that people are unaware of how the interest in the monetary system affects what we call inflation and deflation. Sorry, I'm just double-checking, Stephen. Am I in the right chat room there now? I've just joined into the Revolution Radio chat. I'll just say hi. I'll just give a smiley face into the chat there. I'm coming up as Vinny. Is that the right chat box? I'm in there to see questions.
Yes, Vinny's joined the channel. That's it.
There we go. Lovely. Okay, so hello, everybody in the Revolution Radio chat box. But deflation and inflation, for example, when you purchase a home and you spend, say, $100,000 euros on a home, and then a couple of years later, maybe you can sell that home for $500,000, for example. This actually happened in Ireland, folks. We had what they call a Celtic Tiger economy. And people were of the opinion that they were making a profit of $400,000 on their home. Actually, they were not. That's not true. In the numbers, you were, but not in the value for your money. In other words, what had happened was, essentially, 5 years ago, this house, you needed to collect $100,000 euros to purchase this home. And now 5 years later, that same home has just become five times more expensive because your wages has not gone up in accordance. So you now need to collect $500,000 to purchase that home. So, of course, if you sell your home, even though you bought it for $100,000, you now have, let's assume you have a $400,000 surplus, inverted commas, but yet you're not going to find another home for that same, with all the same amenities and location, etc., for that class of money. It's just not going to happen. So what was happening was people then start financing purchases on the back of other purchases. We had people, I call it a daisy chain. People essentially were becoming like mini bankers themselves, Stephen. They were using the finance, the inverted commas financial gain that was showing on a balance sheet of a bank account, this new 400,000, to finance the purchasing of two or three or four more houses. People were becoming little landlords and building little empires. Little did they know, of course, that they were actually the targeted audience for eradication, that they had to build them up, get them into as much debt as possible. And then once the bubble burst, see, that was the inflation part of the bubble. And once the bubble bursts, the bank gets to reclaim everything, gets to refinance everything again, gets to evict you, repossess all your properties, gets to decimate your life. You'll end up on social welfare where you now almost have zero privacy. You have to tell the government agencies everything about you. And your children must be vaccinated, whether you like it or not. You must go to all these different extremes. So I'm going to call them extremes to obtain services just to keep a roof over your head, food on the table. And, it's humanity interacting with humanity via these, I'm going to call them thought forms or, intellectual mechanisms, because that's really what banking is. It's ink on paper. It's just an idea, you know. And we are essentially giving permission to bankers and institutions and governments to essentially, with our cooperation in ignorance or in nescience most of the time, we're giving them permission to do it to us.
Yes, we are.
It is that crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Silence is consent in a court of law.
Well, silence is consent not only just in a court of law. It's quite regularly consent in our own lives, too. I mean, how many times have you been somewhere with a friend or something and they just look and they say, well, I'm going to make a cup of coffee here myself. And they just make two cups of coffee and they just hand you one. You don't say anything. You just pick up the cup of coffee and you drink it. That was your silent acquiescence as well. I think we need to recognize these things in our own lives as well, not just... At least that's what we found here, trying to assist people as much as we can about education, between what these concepts in the legal realm, what they actually mean, we find it's much simpler if you take the concept from the legal realm, which gets very confusing for people, and just bring it into a normal everyday life situation. Suddenly it's much easier to understand, it's easier to explain it to people, and it's easier for those ideas and notions to spread. I've regularly said that if you can't explain something, a legal situation to a child, if you can't explain it to a child so he understands it, you probably don't understand it either.
That's right. I wanted to go back. You mentioned something just a few minutes ago about the banking system pretty much taking over the governing system. I think the story goes out there that around the beginning of the 19th century, there was the French and English War. And one of the Rothschild sons allegedly took over the Bank of England by selling it short from false information.
Yeah, he surreptitiously and deceptively, that's what happened. Made it look like that's not what happened. Yeah, so he essentially, there was a battle, and the result of that battle, whether it was, say, a victory for one side or the other, depended greatly on how people would buy and sell shares. So what he did was he had somebody over there who informed him early of the result of the battle. And back in old Blighty in England, he starts selling all his shares in things that actually he was going to hang on to. But he started to sell them real cheap and as quick as he possibly could. That caused everybody else to panic and to start doing the same, because they thought, well, he must have some inside information, which clearly he did. But it led them all to start selling and driving the prices down. Once the price dropped down low enough, he then began to buy everything he could get his hands on. He bought everything then. And of course, it was an incorrect result. Nobody should have been selling. They all should have, in fact, been buying. And when the dust had settled, he was now sitting on the top of the pile. He had managed to trick everybody, essentially, into, because of his conduct and his behavior, they all looked to him because they knew he was shrewd. He sold very cheap, waited until they all start doing the same, and then when he reckoned it was as cheap as it was going to be, he then started buying everything that everybody else was selling. And he ended up with a big pile, shall we say, and nothing has changed since. That's still the way it is.
Yeah. Patrick said that was Napoleon's Waterloo, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. 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 Again, even when I'm talking about situations like this, I don't necessarily worry about being historically accurate or naming the battle. I like to just give people the concept. Because once you understand the concept, you don't necessarily have to remember the date or any of that. I mean, you can do. But once you understand the concept of how he did what he did, that's what's really important, because that's why you can discern for yourself how come this happened. I think with stories like that, if you stick in names and battles and who said what to whom and all this and try to be as accurate as possible, if I was writing a book, I'd be accurate. But just on a radio talk show, to try to give people the information and convey the concept, I think it's more important to do it that way.
Now, it's been about another 10 or 12 years ago, Finn, that me and my dad, we were living together and sharing finances and stuff like that. And we were actually also working together. But we both went to this little seminar like deal, and there was a group of people that were selling mutual funds. They were just for ABC Mutual Fund, whatever the name of it was, but we had both gotten a couple each for $2,000, and we had $4,000 each invested. After a year, we were seeing the monthly returns, and it would be up 1 month and down another month and up 1 month and down another month. But I think after a full year, I had the interest gained of like $18 off my initial investment. I had
over how long?
A full year.
You got $18 in a year.
Yeah.
Wow. What did you do? Go to the pictures to celebrate?
Yeah.
On your phone.
Went out to dinner.
Bought half a bag of popcorn.
I lost your video, by the way, but...
No, that's just me having a cigarette off camera.
I thought you said you were going to stop that.
Yeah, I did say that, and I am going to.
But anyways, I ended up talking to the guy again, and he actually was a schoolmate of mine, and he was kind of getting into that and doing that kind of stuff. And he said to me that mutual funds and things similar to that were basically like robbing Peter to pay Paul.
It depends on how they're set up. I don't really... While they're important, if you're involved in all that, it's important to know about them. But if we go into the minutiae of all the different aspects of banking, like that movie does, The Big Short, that's what I think contributes to the confusion. And sorry, just there was a point somebody made on the chat box. I just want to go back and address it on Revolution Radio. They were saying it's 30-year cycles, warm and dry Irish. Yeah, 30-year cycles as well. There's 70-year cycles, there's 30-year cycles. And now it seems we're down to probably a 20-year cycle and maybe even a 10-year cycle if we're lucky. That's why the banking system wants to bring about the cashless society, Stephen.
They've got more control that way, don't they?
Well, they've absolute control. That's if cash goes, folks, I'm not going to say game over, because the banking system will not collapse, folks. I've seen and heard many, many people say this for 30 odd years. I can't see the banking system going anywhere. That's why I'm trying to come up with a mechanism whereby we can cope with the banking system as it is until we can bring about either mathematically perfected economy, or if somebody knows anything better than that, well, by all means, I'm open to hearing about it. I have yet to hear, and I have heard, in case people start hammering me with systems, I have pretty much heard of every system I think going at the moment, be it lawful banks and, you know, barter networks and let's schemes and time banking and all of these things. I have looked at all of them. The only one I've found to date that I can say is aptly named and correctly named is mathematically perfected economy. Because as far as I can tell, I've researched it heavily. It addresses every single issue.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. I'm not even positive what the usury system is, Vin. Would you like to explain that a little bit?
Sure. Usury, to explain it to a child, again, is the easiest way. If there are only, let's say I am the creator of marbles. I'm the first guy on the planet to invent marbles. I've created 10 marbles, and I take a tin of marbles, and I say, hey, Stephen, would you like to borrow some of my marbles? And you say, sure. And I say, well, how many would you like to borrow? And you say, 10. And I say, certainly. But I'll give you these 10 marbles on the condition that you give me back 12. And you agree to that. Even though in that single transaction, you would know, well, but it's impossible for me to give you back 12. You've only got 10. There's only 10 in existence.
I guess just for the game, I'll say yes, I have to agree to it.
Right. Now, what happens is, essentially, you don't get to borrow all 10 in one go. What I do is I meet 10 people and I lend them one marble each on the condition that they'll give me back 2 marbles. And how they get 2 marbles is they go play you in a game of marbles. And they try to win your marble from you, and they can come back then and pay me my interest marble and the original marble. So now there's only 8 in circulation. Every time that happens, only 5 of those 10 people that I lent those marbles to can actually pay me my marble of interest and my original marble. The other 5 people have 0. They have no marbles. It's absolutely impossible for them to pay me. Now, this is where people get confused and they call the monetary system a Ponzi scheme. It's not a Ponzi scheme. That doesn't quite fit. If you look up even on Wikipedia, in fact, there's a good description of what a Ponzi scheme is. Banking is not a Ponzi scheme. I suppose it sort of looks similar from some angles, but it's not really when you think
just,
through it.
Just a hypothetical question real quick. Wouldn't the Wall Street and mutual fund business be a Ponzi scheme if they are robbing Peter to pay Paul?
Not quite, because that Ponzi schemes don't really rob Peter to pay Paul. Ponzi schemes rely on more and more and more people joining it, and Ponzi schemes, they don't have an interest schedule in that either, in that structure. It's a pyramid scheme whereby as people join, you're paying to join. Whereas in banking, you're not actually paying to join banking. When you join banking, you actually you create financial instruments, which are then hypothecated. It's a different structure. and as I said, the Wikipedia, excuse me, if you look up Wikipedia, you'll see that it's a very distinct difference, which is why I don't like people using that term Ponzi scheme for banking. But either way, the 5 people who are now lacking not only the marble of vital circulation, they're also lacking the marble of interest. Now, if I, at the time when I lent them those marbles, also on top of the agreement, I had a failure clause, a default clause. If you can't return the marble I lend you and you can't return the marble of interest, I get possession of your home, literally the roof over your head, and they have agreed to it. Now, if, for example, there's 1 million people and I produce 1 million marbles or 3 million marbles or 10 million marbles and I start lending out marbles, if I also manufacture the marbles and I'm the only marble manufacturer, and this is what banks are, they are the only ones who are licensed to print the currencies. And because they're the only ones who can produce it, you're not allowed to produce a marble to pay back to me. You have to pay me back with my own marble plus my own marble that was issued and you've agreed to collect it as an interest marble. And because of that, I, as a bank, I'm actually in full control over what happens in the system. So in other words, if I decide to stop lending marbles to people, all the people out there who've borrowed marbles, they still have the obligation to go collect the marble off everyone else and give it back to me. So I'm still collecting all the marbles all the time.
And oh, by the way, I'm going to take some of your marbles for that hard work too.
Right, exactly. They get a little slice of the action. And on top of that, they get to dispossess you of your worldly goods, your lawfully obtained goods, possessions, call them what you will, your properties. And they then agree to start manufacturing marbles again and to start putting marbles back into circulation again, at interest of a marble, if you'll agree as a people via your government to no longer consider, say, your natural resources. They now move on to the bank's side of the balance sheet. They're now the bank's natural resources. So your oil, your gas, your fishing, your land, your water, your coal, your minerals, everything. Everything starts to shift from the people's side of the balance sheet, if you will, over to the banker's side of the balance sheet, all with your government's agreement. All governments essentially are in breach of trust, Stephen. Governments are supposedly created amongst men, and it's a trust situation. It's a fiduciary position where they're supposedly doing this for our benefit. They're supposedly servants of we, the people. They're not actually, they're public servants, and there's a big difference between the public and the people. And the public has essentially become the commercial public. And the commercial public, that's why we have PLCs, public limited companies. That's the public they're talking about. They don't mean you, folks. On top of that, the government gave everybody in the country an employment position. Most people don't recognize it as an employment position, but essentially the birth certificate. You'll hear a lot of theories out there on the internet about birth certificates and their bonds that are trading and all of this. I've never found that to be true, but I do know this, that they then use that birth certificate to generate, I don't know what you call it, tax identification number. In Ireland, it's called a PPS number, a SIN number, whatever these numbers are. But essentially, the user, the status of the user of that number is considered to be an employee of the corporate government, which is why you have access to social services and pension funds and all of that stuff under that guise. So they address you as the public from that legal perspective, if you will, as an employee, which is why, of course, people are confused in courtrooms when they don't understand why they're not getting the benefits of the Constitution, etc., because the Constitution wasn't for corporate employees of the commercial government. That was set up like a ghost-like figure to duplicate the image of what the government was supposedly supposed to be under the different constitutions. Same thing happened here in Ireland, it happened in India, Australia. It's happened everywhere, folks. Everywhere the British Empire was, this is still the way it is. I'm sad to report. That seems to be the way it is. Everything I've seen seems to back that up. All the research I've done over all the years, everything seems to back that up. Some people get angry and upset about that. I don't. I just decided, well, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. But what can we do about it? So that's why what we were always working towards was, well, what can we do about this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Vin, we've actually got about 2.5-3 minutes here, but I wanted to go over a couple of comments that somebody in the chat there, Warm, Dry, and Irish. I wonder if that's one of our friends. But
that's where everybody's Irish.
Yeah. Okay. 75 million of us over here in America, but... So we've lost all our marbles, man. Yes, we have.
Well, that's why I use marbles as a expression, because that's what happens is you must be losing your marbles to get involved.
Exactly. You are in a bank. You are an employee. Your money is not yours. But you have to be in a bank to get paid, to be human, be a person.
Well, again, you see, the banking system, you don't actually get paid. What we're actually doing is we're affecting payment. It's only an effect. You see, don't forget, every time the bank prints currency notes, dollars, euro notes, they issue them into circulation, or rather they're borrowed into circulation. They print them, and then somebody has to borrow them into circulation. And then as you're paying back your loan, they still have the $10 bill or the $5 bill or the 10 euro note to recirculate again, to lend to somebody else, and you still owe interest. I swear to God, Stephen, there's no way the existing monetary system could come into place tomorrow if it didn't exist for the last couple of hundred years with usury involved.
Exactly.
If we were living with a mathematically perfected economy and I tried to introduce modern usurious banking, I'd be put against a wall and shot.
You certainly would, yep.
And rightly so.
Well, I want to go ahead and let you go here so I can sign off and then join everybody in the other chat.
No problem. Well, it was great to talk to you, Stephen. So are you finished up now, or?
Yeah, in about a minute here, yes.
Okay. Well, I'll still be going broadcast for the next 2 hours live on People's Internet Radio if anybody wants to track over there.
Absolutely. www.peoplesinternetradio.com.
Thanks, Stephen.
Have a good day.
Cheerio.
Yes, everyone. I know Hawk has got something to do, something about the, I've been seeing it in the chat there, something live going on up there in Oregon. So I'm going to go ahead and let studio go early. Thanks, everyone, for coming out. I'm Stephen Robertson. This is Cancel Like a Ball. Thank you, everyone.